Good morning. Good morning, everyone. My name is Rohan Silver. I work for the British government. Thank you for trudging through the rain and braving such an early start to be here this morning. If any of you have forgotten that the clocks have changed and actually think you're here to hear about, I don't know, Indonesian high-speed broadband policy, just put up your hand at any point and I'll try and ask questions about that too. When I was invited to speak here at South by Southwest about Britain and technology, there were lots of things that we could have talked about, that I could have talked about, to do with the way in which we're trying to build a better environment for technology investment, introducing things like the entrepreneur visa, new tax breaks for early-stage investment, our incredible open data agenda, which is genuinely world-leading, which Tim Kelsey is going to be celebrating with you in this room after my session. There are lots of things we could talk about, because in a sense, what's happened in the UK is that there's been a government of geeks takeover. The election in May 2010 ended up with a Chancellor of the Exchequer who used to cycle to work wearing a Mozilla T-shirt, and we have a Prime Minister, David Cameron, who really does spend a crazy, scary amount of time playing Fruit Ninja on his iPad. It really is true. And so, you know, we've had this great opportunity to try and rethink the way we do government, to try and bring government into the digital age, into the 21st century. And that's what I really want to talk about today, the way in which we're trying to use new technologies, the kind of technologies that I'm sure you've all helped bring into the world, trying to use new technology to change the relationship between the citizen and the state, to try and give people new powers to influence policymaking, to feed in their ideas directly and have them impact on government. So, you know, I'm calling this our adventures in crowdsourcing. And you might say, well, you know, why do you need to do this? What's the, you know, isn't government sort of works okay, doesn't it? Why do we need to change anything? Government might work okay, but my Prezi isn't. Good. That's a good start. Sorry, guys, be with you in a sec. Okay. So, what is wrong with the way government works right now? I spotted this online. This is the House of Lords, the kind of august second chamber of the British political system. And there are four people here who are either asleep, having a stroke, both. And if you look at what they're supposed to be debating, it's something really important, right? This is a debate on reducing the number of MPs in the House of Commons. It's like reducing the number of congressmen or senators. I mean, undoubtedly a good thing. But, you know, surely this is the kind of moment when, you know, the model we have of representative democracy, when you have experts debating the issue of the day, drawing on their deep well of experience and an insight. This really is how it's supposed to work. And now, I might say, well, things could be different, but a political theorist would probably respond and say, well, actually, there's a reason we have the system of government we have. We can't go back to the old popular democracy, the idea that all citizens could vote on every law, all citizens could debate the happenings of the day, you know, wearing badass psychedelic togas. You know, we just can't go back to that kind of world. Well, my contention, the contention I'm going to share with you today, is that I think we can. I think there are elements of popular democracy that we can bring into the way government works. We can reform government using new technology, using the tablets, the smartphones, the internet, so as to rethink and reconfigure and recast the political settlement for the 21st century. And, you know, after all, a teenager in their bedroom has access to more information now than an entire government would have done 30 years ago. I mean, just to state the bleeding obvious. But in truth, government hasn't really changed, right? I mean, the information revolution obliterating the asymmetries of power and information that used to separate citizens from the state, from the governed to the governing, none of that is really changing government, not fundamentally. The kind of changes you're seeing in the content industry, in wider tech space, really has left government unchanged, I would argue. Now, my story really begins with this man, David Miliband, handsome devil that he is. And David Miliband, for those of you who don't know, was this young, thrusting Labour politician. He was energy and environment minister for a while. And in case you think I'm being unfair to him, this is what he normally looks like. that really is him. And David Miliband, as a sort of, to be fair to him, bright young man, decided that we could do government differently. This was about 4 or 5 years ago. And he said, well, look, why don't we have a wiki? Wikis are sort of in. People are talking about wikis. Let's wiki government. And he proposed, he set up a quick wiki on which people could comment on and try and reconfigure environment policy. Right, so contentious, interesting stuff. And as a high-minded man, David Miliband, I'm sorry, my thing is crashing again. Sorry. Bear with me for just 1 second. This is not a great advert, is it, for the power of technology? But hold on. So, yeah, David Miliband set up this wiki on environment policy and energy policy, and being a high-minded young man, he posed some really thorny, philosophical, high-minded questions. Who are the parties to the environmental contract, he asked. That's a sort of deep question, right? It's sort of Rousseau and Locke and Burke, and it's sort of, good stuff. Within seconds, and I really mean seconds, I don't mean sort of minutes, hours, the internet struck and turned who are the parties to the environmental contract on his wiki into where is the party for the environmental contract? Can I come? Will there be cake? Hooray, right? Fair play. He also asked questions like, what tools can be used to create the right incentive framework? Again, what a deep, meaningful question that is. High-minded, high-spirited. Answer, a big stick and an owl magnet, right? Those are the tools that should be used. Now, to be fair to David Miliband, this is quite a high-profile failure, and I think it points to a particular challenge we're facing in government when you try and open up policymaking, because a purely open system really can fall foul to activists, malicious spammers, etc. So the challenge, I think, which is unique to government maybe, is how can you have a system that's simultaneously open and closed? And David Miliband said, the experiment will go on. Now, for him, The experiment ended. He was beaten by his little brother in the leadership contest for the Labour Party. His experiment ended, but it was just beginning for us. And back in 2007, I was working for a man called George Osborne, the guy who I mentioned used to wear a Mozilla T-shirt to work, and we did a speech on open source politics that touched on lots of things. Oh, really? Is there anything you can do in the back there about the feedback? Yeah. Okay. Is that better? Okay. He said, we want to usher in open source politics. And we weren't talking just about crowdsourcing back then. We were talking about embedding open standards in government IT, creating a level playing field for open source software. We used it to kind of capture a whole bunch of things. But I'm just going to talk about the crowdsourcing part of it now. And you know, obviously, we were sort of inspired by Innocentive and the Netflix $1 million prize to improve algorithms. I mean, all this stuff that you know you guys would know inside out. We were very moved by this idea that you know a closed cabal of experts in government might be replaced or supplanted or complemented by the wisdom of the crowd. So you know, all very high-minded stuff, but it pains me to say that our first use of crowdsourcing wasn't quite so high-minded. We got our mitts on a leaked government IT report, and this IT report was terrible. It was a really really poor piece of work, and it was describing a vision of IT that was closed and sclerotic and expensive, and we thought there must be something else we can do with this beyond just leak it to a newspaper, right? I mean, that's what you're supposed to do when you get hold of a leaked document. You leak it to someone else. And so we did something interesting with it. We posted the leaked document on a WordPress website. I'm going to have one more go at this and then give up. And I think what I'll do for a bit is I'm going to try it. Maybe this USB thing is causing it to quit. We built a WordPress site on which we posted the government's IT report looking for feedback from the crowd, right? So rather than us give it to a journalist who does a hatchet job, let's open it out to the community of techies and experts to pull it apart. Not just for kind of political advantage, but so that we might end up with a better IT policy as a result. And as we wrote on that initial document, on that initial WordPress site, we said, we think there's a better way of making policy. Not only is it possible to develop a more ambitious, cost-effective, and transformative vision for government IT, but we also believe it's possible to pursue a completely different approach to making policy, rather than the traditional closed approach that this report typifies. We want to throw open the process and let the people in. So still sort of brings a lump to my throat. All the way back in 2007, we were saying that. And just to kind of assure you that it wasn't all kind of political skullduggery, we were also developing this really ambitious open data agenda, which, as I say, Tim Kelsey is going to talk about. I won't go on about that now, but you know, suffice it to say, this sort of vision of opening up government extends to other domains beyond crowdsourcing. Now, in May 2010, we got into government. We had all these ideas of crowdsourcing and so on. And the problem was that the financial crisis struck. This is a Greek in crisis. It was the least racist picture of a Greek in crisis I could find. It's George Michael coked up, getting arrested. The way in which most European countries responded to the financial crisis and to the sort of challenge of reducing public spending was to do something like this, right? This is Mario Monti, the technocrat, unelected, elite, professorial leader of Italy, right? So their response, Italy's response to the spending crisis was employ that kind of one expert who can sit in a room and fix everything, right? Classic, traditional response. And we'll see whether it works. We did something very different. In the UK, we had to bring about, we felt we had to make the biggest spending cuts in modern British history. And we didn't just want to sit in a room somewhere in the bowels of the Treasury and come up arbitrarily with the answer. So we put something on the Treasury website that we call the Spending Challenge. And we said to people, look, you know, you're the ones who experience public services. You're the ones who work in the public sector. Why don't you tell us what you think the problem is? Now, I've got to say, we faced a fair amount of skepticism. As you can maybe read there, someone, this was the top entry on July the 10th, 2010, someone wrote, here's an idea to save money. Create a website where the entire population of the UK can make absurd suggestions on how the government can save money. Allow easy access and registration so that users can create multiple accounts to vote on their own suggestions. And as hundreds of thousands of citizens will be sat on their computer, there will not be a drain on government resources outside their own homes, so saving money, which is an inspired idea. And the cynicism didn't end there, unfortunately. We also built a Facebook page, which... I'm sorry about this. We also built a Facebook page, which was immediately disrupted. There was a rival Facebook page that was... a rival Facebook page which compared our popularity in crowdsourcing with that of a goat, which worked well. Here's the goat. Can this goat get more followers than the HM Treasury spending challenge? This was a few months ago. Goat 65, government 72. 8 more fans and we're there. So, look, that's the kind of skepticism you face, right? And, however, from public sector workers, we got 65,000 responses, right? We said to people who work in the public sector, you're the ones who know what processes are inefficient, which teams really, frankly, don't do very much. Let us know what you think. 65,000 entries, 100,000 entries from the general public. And the... what we ended up with were dozens of spending review changes that came directly from the public. Dozens. And this is George Osborne welcoming some public sector workers into number 11 Downing Street, his humble Georgian house. And these are all people whose ideas have not only just been received, but were being implemented. So this was him telling them, sort of surprising them really, saying, hey, do you know what? You fed in some ideas a few weeks ago. We're now... implementing those in our spending review. So a completely different approach to a spending challenge, a political and also policy challenge to, say, the Italian approach. The thing is, and the obstacles that I've been describing so far are sort of political obstacles, right? It's sort of activists who take the piss, people who post up stupid things, funny things. But in government, there's another obstacle, which is the kind of establishment, which is the civil service, the kind of orthodoxy that says, look, there's a reason that civil servants are there. There's a reason that we have experts in these domains. We can't just open it out to the kind of hordes, to people like you. I think this is sort of typified in this quick clip. So these were the sort of examples that came in, all very techy, all very good. We implemented them.
The wrong people get it. If the right people don't have power, do you know what happens? The wrong people get it. Politicians, councillors, ordinary voters.
But aren't they supposed to in a democracy?
This is a British democracy.
How do you mean?
British democracy recognises that you need a system to protect the important things of life and keep them out of the hands of the barbarians. Things like the opera. Radio 3. The countryside. The law...
Oh, there. Okay. Well, anyway, look, we were undaunted by... Sir Humphrey, as they call him, and instead we ploughed on regardless. We said, "Look, right. So we've tried crowdsourcing spending; that's worked pretty well. Why don't we try to crowdsource some legislation? We've looked at how." You know, the finances work. Why don't we look at how the legislative system works when you throw it open and let people in? So we had this sort of idea of having the first piece of crowdsourced legislation anywhere in the world. And we called it your Freedom Bill. And what this piece of legislation was intended to do was try and strip away some of the draconian state surveillance, anti-civil liberty type of policies that had built up over, frankly, many decades. And we did the kind of obvious. We built a very simple website where you could post your ideas. And we got 140,000 submissions, which I think really sort of shows the kind of pent-up desire to get involved. That's not page views. That's not visitors to the site. That's people who have actively engaged. As ever with this kind of thing, yes, we had, please repeal the regulation that dogs must be carried on escalators. That's a good one. I assume this came from some PR department somewhere. Anyone caught manufacturing, packing, transporting, selling, cooking, or serving baked beans that are not Heinz should be sent to prison for 5 years. But my particular favorite, which I assume came from some mad evil genius somewhere, was the government should pass a law whose sole purpose is to repeal itself, thus ensnaring the entire legal framework of the nation in a paradox. This is an absolutely inspired idea. Sadly, we couldn't do that. We debated it for many weeks with philosophers, but we couldn't make it work. Instead, the legislation wound up including a whole bunch of really great things that was fed into from the public for code of practice for surveillance, limitations to the amount of time that people can be held in detention without trial, and really fantastic changes to the criminal justice system so that people who have convictions, criminal records that date back to when homosexuality was illegal, those criminal records are going to be swept away. So really fantastic changes in this piece of legislation. And we didn't just innovate, I think, in the way in which we got the ideas in. Once we drafted the legislation, drawing on these suggestions from the public, we then published that legislation in an open format so that legal experts, busybodies, whoever, could pick apart the drafting of the legislation, could say, hang on, the way you drafted this clause won't work. It will have this unintended consequence. It will be misapplied or misinterpreted by the courts. And that was really fantastic because, you know, as you probably know, legislation often gets passed in a hurry. It gets signed through Parliament. The Lords are asleep or dying or whatever it is. And mistakes in the drafting don't get noticed until the bill is passed, until it affects the real world. And that, frankly, is too late. And so opening out the scrutiny process, a bit like peer-to-patent in the US, Beth Novick's fantastic initiative, really did make a difference, I think. Hopefully we can change this. So this really was working fine earlier. The old... Let me just close this as well. All right. Okay. So that was our approach. I've talked about our approach to spending. I've talked about our approach to regulation. This is our latest salvo. We call it the red tape challenge. And, you know, what we found with the Freedom Bill, this piece of legislation I just mentioned, was that people get very het up about regulations and laws they bump into, the kind of friction involved in dealing with government. And we thought, let's really harness that. You know, so you're not asking people abstract questions about what incentives you should use to transform the environment, like that wiki I mentioned at the start. This is much more crunchy. This is, what are the regulations that you bump into as a business person or as a regular person that just get on your tits, that really make your life more difficult than it should be? And we learned the lesson from the Facebook GOAT episode. We were using LinkedIn, which I've got to say has led to a much better quality of conversation because, you know, it's a professional network. You're trying to show off to your peers, I suppose, about your prowess in technical areas. So LinkedIn has been a great tool. It's been a learning for us. And we've, of course, built our own little website very cheaply. And as you can see from this, the kinds of issues that we're asking people to comment on are really technical. You know, this is about the way in which blood is stored and good laboratory practice and clinical trials. This is not sort of airy-fairy stuff. This requires deep domain expertise, I think, to engage properly. And then something I think might be particularly interesting for you guys in the room is we've also got a strand of this looking at disruptive business models, by which we mean if you've tried to start a business or do something different, innovative, and you've run into regulations designed for another era. So you're a peer-to-peer lending company, and you're getting regulated in the same way as the banks. You've tried to set up an online property company, estate agent company, real estate agent company, and you're being hit by regulations designed for the old world. Well, this is the place to come and complain about it. And the thing that's really radical about this, because, you know, a challenge when crowdsourcing in government, or anywhere, I suppose, is what is the feedback loop? How can people really be sure that you're going to do something with the response? Now, I think we've done a decent-ish job of saying, well, look, ideas that came in on spending, they got implemented quite quickly. Ideas for legislation ended up in the legislation. But we've done something much more radical here. So this is how this works. You flag up a problem with a regulation on the website, on LinkedIn, and then that immediately gets put on probation. It gets that regulation you've complained about gets scrapped unless the responsible body, the bit of government, can justify the existence of that regulation or reform it. So a very powerful driver for change. You complain about something, it gets scrapped unless it can be justified or reformed. We've had 30,000 entries in just a few months, which is, I think, pretty spectacular given, as I say, the kind of the dense technical nature of the issue. Sorry. So we've had 30,000 entries so far in just a few months, including a weird, weird epic poem about seafarers. That's my own photo, but the poem that was sent in is sort of Beowulf in length. But we've had 250 regulations already scrapped as a result of what's been fed in. 250, and 500 more are being reformed as direct feedback to the things that have been complained about. And I won't sort of bore you with the kinds of things that we're changing, but this is about smoke-free signs in bed and breakfast, and we're going to change that. This is about the way in which the legislation governing how old you've got to be to buy cigarettes and alcohol, etc., works. We're changing that too. This is about the employment law tribunal system. So, like, crunchy, techie stuff, but all leading to change via this crowdsourcing process. All issues that, frankly, we'd never have known about unless it was for people taking part, being given the opportunity to feed in. So all the examples I've given so far, I suppose, are about central government changing, right? The way we spend money, the way we legislate, the way we regulate, right? Central government stuff. But, of course, lots of government is not about just central government. There are many tiers, many aspects of government elsewhere. And I think there you possibly need a different approach. And this is an example of that different approach. These are crime maps that we introduced January last year, stolen shamelessly from Chicago and Washington and great American cities. And that's my house surrounded by a sort of, you know, hotbed of crime. And the reason we've done this, it's partly because there was big demand, right? That's the first day this thing went live, 18 million hits an hour. I think it was 6 million hits in the first 3 hours that the site went live, which was great. But the thing crashed, obviously. Lots of concern, lots of kind of lame cynicism about whether house prices would get hit, right? I mean, this is the sort of thing you expect. But the reason we're doing this, the reason we created those crime maps was not for sort of prurience or surveillance or voyeurism or anything like that. It's to try and give people some parity when talking to the police. Enable people to say, hey, I know why there's so much crime in that area, which I can see on the crime map. It's because there are no streetlights. So fix the streetlights and you'll sort the crime. You know, suddenly empowered with that information, people can start making policy. People can start, you know, feeding in their ideas directly to the police. And we've created new structures, beat meetings, elected police commissioners, etc. So these kind of crowdsourced ideas can actually have a place to go. Another example of this, This is going to crash again. Is New England, where you know we're in Old England. In New England, as you probably know, there are town hall meetings where people can get together and decide on the zoning system, decide on how the planning system works. Well, we sort of think that maybe technology can allow you to do something similar in the UK. The New England model is quite a cool, popular democracy, old world, psychedelic togas kind of thing. But maybe we can use online platforms, SimCity, I suppose, type platforms, to open up that planning process, that zoning process, to anyone who wants to turn up online and engage. That's very radical. It hasn't been, it's not in place yet, but it's going to be soon. And it's an example, I think, of the different ways you've got to approach this as you look at different levels of government. All right, let me just, for the 20th time, try and get to the right place. I am sorry about this.
Reinforcing the information every time.
Yeah. Good. Well, there's going to be a pop quiz at the end of this, so good to hear. I'm assuming it's the photo of the gay sailors that's just crashing my machine. I've got a lot more photos like that on my hard disk, you see. So that's New England. That's SimCity. All right, so that sort of brings you up to date on what we're doing, right? Looking at crowdsourcing at different levels of government. And I just wanted to take a minute just to describe what we're doing next, just to give you a bit of an insight into where this is going. One thing we're doing is we're building a very cheap and cheerful app, a sort of management informatics dashboard that's going to go on the Prime Minister's Fruit Ninja-laden iPad. And what's sort of great about it, I think, is that not only will this app bring together government data from across the public sector, which you kind of need, I think, if you're trying to run a government, but a whole bunch of crowdsourced data too. So YouGov data, what was your last experience of the National Health Service like? What was your last interaction with the education system like? That kind of bubbling up data is going to be there too. From the likes of Google, real-time search query data on, you know, looking for job centers and information about employment, giving you fantastic information about the job market, employment market in real time. Similarly, real-time inflation data drawn from millions of price points across the internet. So suddenly, instead of having lagging indicators, using the kind of crowd, data generated by the crowd, maybe, just maybe, we can improve the way government interacts with the rest of government. This brings with it a kind of challenge, though, I think, which is that you've got lots of big data sets in government, and trying to spot correlations and trends with those data sets is hard, right? And there are many thousands of statisticians in government, but frankly, none of them really have kind of big data expertise. And that's why we're turning to a fantastic outfit called LinkedGov. And Hadley from LinkedGov is going to say a few words about how we are trying to use crowdsourcing to help us with this data analysis, which is just so important for a more effective public sector. So over to you. Yeah, this one here.
Perfect.
Thanks.
Thank you, Rohan. Taking a step back from crowdsourcing data analysis, because in my head that's sort of the end of the journey that we're on, my background is in designing collaborative technologies, and particularly in the public sector in the UK, in government. So I'm interested in helping people work together when they're not in the same place. I've been a big fan of the open data movement since it began, and I've been particularly keeping an eye on the vision of how this is going to open up all kinds of resources for new companies to grow and for new levels of accountability, new relationship between citizen and the state, that sort of thing. But I found myself finishing a project about a year and a half ago and hadn't laid on another one yet. I thought I'll take a couple of weeks out and have a bit of a holiday. And my first day off, I met with a friend of mine who's a civil servant in the Department for Transport. And we were just having a chat for a coffee, and she said, I was working on, ages ago, the Treasury data, the coins data, combined online spending data, which had just been published. And now this has gone out to the press and to all the developers of the world, great, huge amount of data, fantastic resource, and they're all coming to me, everyone I know, all my friends, and saying, what does this budget code mean? What is this program object code? how does this work? And unfortunately, that data modeling information and the meaning of those codes wasn't written down clearly in a way that we could publish it to the outside world. And it's a fairly complex system that covers every government department and then all of the directorates in the departments and then all the teams in the directorates in the departments. So it's not an easy thing to sort of hand the book to someone and say, here, this will answer all your questions. And I started thinking, we've got all these people with questions and all these people like her with answers who want to help but can't answer the same question 300 times. What we really need is, if each question and each answer maps to one piece of data, we need a system to work this out. We can very easily say, right, you have a question on this piece, you're the one with the answer, can we bring these together? So, foolishly, I thought, I'll put 3 weeks into this, and then I'll take another project, and it'll be fine. That was a year and a half ago, and I'm still working on it now. It's now a startup, which has been generously funded by a technology strategy board, part of government. And we've extended it beyond just coins to all public data sets. And as soon as I started sort of sketching out the plans in those early days, it occurred to me that not only do we have the same problems with every data set, a lot of them have things like acronyms or codes in them that make sense to the team that was publishing them but aren't very usable if you're outside that team. There's also varying qualities of data and understandability of data, which makes sense, really, for some of what you're doing. If you're counting desks on a floor to work out staffing resources for the next year, it doesn't really matter if you're off by five. And there's no point in putting lots of taxpayer money into making that data perfect. But we do have data to release to the outside world and those sorts of things, and we want to put on that data some kind of label or mechanism to tell whoever's using the data, yeah, this isn't perfect. If you need a ballpark figure, go for it. If you need something perfect, then I'm sorry, we're not able to help you right now. So what we're doing is this great big crowdsourcing exercise of trying to match little bits of information with the right bits of data so that when anyone comes along to either run analysis, to do any kind of democratic engagement, to build new companies, whatever it is they want to do with the data, it should be as understandable as possible pretty much from the get-go. Mm. It's a huge amount of work. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of data sets, tens of thousands of data teams across the public sector. And the big problem is that no one person has the time or the patience or really the interest in doing it themselves. No company can really afford it. So what we really need to do is make it easy for a lot of people to be able to help with just a little bit, right? 5 minutes per person across all the people who care about having open data available. This should go pretty fast. What we've done is turning all of the tasks in cleaning this data and linking it and making it usable into games. So we have an API of games that will ask you things like, these are two different terms from different data sets that might be related. You speak English. Can you look at them and tell us if actually they're both abbreviations for the same thing? There are situations like that where the semantic technologies fall apart and a human can sort it out in a hurry. Mm. So that's our initiative to gather as many people as possible to clean this data and then make the outputs usable for everyone.
Very cool. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you. So another great example, I think, of applying crowdsourcing to other bits and bobs. The final thing I just want to touch on, I think got time here for another 3 or 4 system crashes, so that's good. I just want to squeeze a few more in, I think, just to really demonstrate the point. Okay. The thing is that I've been showing you some, I think, quite cool stuff, and I think, honestly, quite world-leading for government anyway, probably a long way behind the private sector in all kinds of ways, but leading for government. We still, thinking of ourselves as a tech-savvy government, publish every single day PDF documents and expect people to feed in. And what happens? A handful of lobbyists, at best, respond to the consultation. You know, it's a total, you know, it's just not good enough, frankly, right? This is what the British government does. I'm sure it's what the American government does, etc. And so we want to radically change the way government does consultations. And this sounds sort of boring and sounds arcane, but I think it really gets to the heart of the policymaking process. You know, it gets to the question of how can we stop just lobbyists responding to government policy? And I think part of the way you do that is by getting out of the habit of simply publishing a document and saying, here's what we're planning to do, have you got any comments? We need to be involving the public much earlier in the process, as we did with spending, as we're doing with regulation, as we did with legislation. And to try and make this happen, we hired last year Beth Novick, who wrote Wiki Government, created Peer to Patent. Beth, on her very first day at Number 10, was stricken down with a very serious illness. We think it might have been caused by the canteen. And for whatever the reason, she sadly had to go back to the States and get better. So I can sort of tell you today that that Jimmy Wales has agreed to become an advisor to the British government, an unpaid advisor, to help us with this agenda, rethinking government consultations, rethinking the way in which we engage the public sector, as we design policy. I mean, I really can't think of a better person to help with this. Hopefully, it doesn't just mean we go back to the David Miliband wiki that I mentioned, although for comedy value, that's always worth a shot. So Jimmy's going to be helping us with this. And as I say, maybe over the next few months, over the next few years, in the UK, elsewhere, we might just start to inch that a little bit further forward towards bringing popular democracy into the heart of our representative democracy. And I think that really would be a very special way to finish. So in the sort of spirit of crowdsourcing, I'm going to get the hell away from this broken computer. Does anyone have any questions about this or anything else you thought you were here to hear about? Yeah, question here.
I have a question about a Switzerland.
I think there's a microphone here if you want to use it.
My question is about rewards and incentives. Do you use rewards and incentives? Is the reward just for the citizen to participate, just seeing government get better? Do you do anything with financial gifts?
Yeah, we haven't used, I think the sort of the nerdy technical jargon is, are you using intrinsic motivations, i.e. do people just feel good about taking part, or some kind of extrinsic motivation? So far, it's been predominantly intrinsic motivations. I mean, it depends whether you're psyched about getting invited to Number 11 and meet the Chancellor. I can understand a lot of people might not want to do that. But I think the feedback loop so far has been, you can make a difference, and we'll show you when your change makes a difference. Something I think interesting, though, is to ask the question, and only sort of speculate, if people are kind of active participants in various crowdsourcing exercises, could they earn special rights, maybe to take part in other processes, more complex processes about how precise budgets are going to be spent, maybe in your local area. I think that idea of kind of earned responsibility is a really interesting one, and maybe one we'll get to with Jimmy's help in the months ahead.
To make it easier for the greater public to get involved earlier, have you thought about enlisting youth so that you can make it more street cred and popularize it so it has a little bit of sex to it?
Yeah, I think it's a very good point. And I've got to say, I think the way we've sort of gone about this so far, because, you know, the risk in government is if you open up just that little bit too much, bad things happen. I don't think we've thought enough about engaging different demographics. You know, we've gone after medical people for our regulations and seafarers with their weird poetry, but we haven't thought enough about young people, older people, etc. I think it's a really good thought and something we need to do.
Hi, I forget your name was
Hadley.
Okay, yeah. So you know, you were talking about utilizing games to take that data and kind of crowdsource it for people to link it up. And I just had a possible feedback or even a question about that, which was, if you've heard of like ReCAPTCHA, where they've taken, you know, the books, I think, or old books and using websites for their CAPTCHA forms to utilize human beings, right, to type in the letters. So that could also be a potential option because websites need CAPTCHA and, you know, they're always looking for different ways to make it easier. You know, hey, help the government and help, you know, and make sure you're a human, you know, something like that.
So,
yeah.
Sorry to run around a bit. No, absolutely. When we first sat down, as soon as I was able to bring together a team to sort of sketch out what we were going to do, one of the things that we decided was that we care about the big picture goals. We care about getting data better. We care about getting as many points of input as possible into the data, but we're not going to be precious about the process. We're not going to say, we built this front end, and that's the way the world's going to look at this program. So you're absolutely right. The more we can distribute the work, the more we can embed it into existing processes and into things that everyone has to do anyway, the better. And that feeds also into the first question around motivations. There are a lot of people who have very personal, intrinsic motivations around making data better explicitly because it's something they want to work with. They have an interest themselves, and we want to make the most of that. But the more we can tap into other ways of getting people to help, even if it is take 3 more seconds in what you're currently doing to answer 1 more question or do 1 more thing, then that's definitely in our interest.
Okay, and then not to hog the mic, but 1 more question.
Sure.
So this was an effort by the UK government,
yeah,
right, to crowdsource basically government policy or feedback from the people, questions, all that stuff. Do you see that? I mean, there's all so many countries, right? Over 190 or 200 countries, you know, or more. I don't even know. But the point is, there's so many countries. And do you see some countries that not wanting to do this, let's say because of budget or lack of understanding of technology or whatever, but that individual like entrepreneurs can actually build, you know, social ventures, causes, whatever, to actually kind of create a platform,
yeah,
that does, in essence, what the UK did? Because I don't know why a government actually has to be behind crowdsourcing government, because the truth is you just need the data. Once you have the data, you can give that into a, you know, a nice little packaged up file to the policy makers and say, here's what the people are saying,
yeah,
and you know, without having them to actually do the legwork.
Yeah, well, look, you know, opening up data and having people do kind of messy and unexpected things with it is a huge part of what we're doing as a government. I didn't talk about it now so much because Tim Kelsey is going to talk about it next, about what we're doing in the UK. I think, though, anyone, of course, can create a platform, right, where you can have petitions, where people can feed in ideas. I think what is perhaps compelling and gets to this point about motivation is if government is doing it, and is doing it in a way that's kind of open and transparent and says, here's what happens with your comment, then there is, I think, more of an incentive to take part. And, you know, frankly, the goal here is not to necessarily to have a new pressure group putting pressure on government, but actually to change government itself. So you're right. Anyone can do this, and I hope lots of people do. But I think it's also important that governments experiment and try stuff out. But I think we should...
Okay, thank you very much. We'll talk after.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hi there. I'd just like to ask about the clarity in the implementation.
Yeah.
You mentioned that, there's some quite far-left ideas coming through, and there were certain ones which were picked up and put into the Freedom Bill. How much of that action was censored or... influenced by the policy makers or the members of the civil service making those decisions? So how much,
yeah,
of those 30,000 suggestions are there actually then being limited by the minds of the people in that?
You know, it's a really good question, and you know, something I'd love to hear comments on afterwards or now is, are there better ways of filtering the kind of comments, right? So you can let people vote on comments, of course. But when the transition team at the White House did this, it just ended up with kind of cannabis kind of right at the top. And maybe that's legitimate, but it's not what the government wanted to do. And so we have so far been quite reliant on civil servants doing the processing and filtering and then giving to us what they think are the most promising ideas. And so you're right that filter, that bottleneck, is something we've really got to watch. And so just to give you a quick example of how we're trying to deal with that, on the red tape challenge, this thing I mentioned about cutting regulation, we bring in independent experts who see every single submission. And these experts are usually kind of maniacs who kind of want to get rid of regulation and do kind of fun stuff, or are experts in technology or whatever. So they're there to keep the civil servants honest and make sure that that filter is a kind of fair filter and not something that is simply used to kind of compound the civil servants' own views of what should happen, because that would be pretty counterproductive. So you're right, and it's something we're very conscious of.
And on the red tape one, with the information at that level, we're using experts to help do that.
Yeah.
How easy are you finding that the local government representation at, say, at the borough councils, things like that, how easily is the suspension of these articles of red tape being heard and also being released as well?
Yeah.
So is the message actually getting from that, because that one's slightly top, in a yeah. nice way, top down,
yeah.
but no, is it reaching the ground level?
It's a fair question, and the truth is, we don't know, because we're still quite early into this process. But one of the sad things about the UK is that it's massively centralised, and you know, basically local government has no regulatory power, it's all central. And so when we suspend a regulation, we're the only people that can. And so, you know, we'll find out soon enough whether things are filtering through. But we're keeping the LinkedIn portal open. So if you're someone who complained about a regulation and it's still being enforced, it's still, you know, it's supposed to have been scrapped, you can keep complaining about it. So that feedback loop will remain. But you're right, it's something we're going to have to watch really closely.
Appreciate what you're doing and you're sharing it with us so we can learn from it. If you divide lawmaking into three phases, what's the problem? What are our options? What are we going to do about it? Yeah. Good examples for the first two phases, but in that third phase where the lawmakers sit down and decide what they're going to do, are there any examples of crowdsourcing or infusion of open data or anything that you're aware of in that phase?
Well, I think in the sort of, what are we going to do? I mean, forgive me if I'm sort of misunderstanding your question, but I think the spending review example is a good example. So that was, in a sense, a traditional process, right? It was sort of men and women sat in rooms deciding how to cut public spending, which programs need to be trimmed, which ones you might spend a bit more on, etc. But what absolutely informed that process were the responses from the crowd. So we had in there a stack of kind of brilliant ideas, mostly from public servants, on get rid of this process, get rid of this form, this team's pointless, etc. And so I think that's a good example of a traditional policymaking process featuring, you know, dudes in a room with bad breath and donuts, making decisions that were informed by the crowd in a very real way. And, you know, we felt a lot of pressure actually to make sure that all those people that had put in entries felt that there was some tangible feedback, that we were actually going to act on the best ideas. So I think that's an example of that. But we do need to do more, of course. And, you know, the work with Jimmy is going to be about trying to embed that kind of approach across government, because these kind of ad hoc processes are great, but I think we're sort of through the experimentation phase. I think we've got our sort of eye in now. We need to make this real right across government.
And similar to that, I think the data is not necessarily at a level of quality and cleanliness where we can produce stuff fast enough to inform every policy-making process sort of as it needs. One of the many reasons that we're working as much as we can.
Hi, Tim Bonneman with Intellitix. One criticism during the spending challenge that I read about was that you get these tens of thousands of submissions, but clearly they're not unique ideas. So do you have any ideas going forward how to enable either the participants or some other editors to theme and synthesize these contributions?
Yeah.
And second question, do you... as far as I know, you've only in your response, you've only covered the ideas that you picked up and implemented. Do you also respond to ideas that you weren't able to implement or that you had to deny?
Yeah. Well, two great questions. The sort of themed approach. So the Red Tape Challenge, which is this latest attempt at crowdsourcing, we've tried to learn from some of the more open-ended processes, which, as you say, led to a lot of duplication. And what precisely are you asking for? The Red Tape Challenge is really narrow. It's really kind of nerdy and arcane. And that means there's much less duplication, because, you know, if you really want to go and comment on regulations to do with how blood is stored, you know, that's where you go. And, you know, in truth, you're not going to get many other responses in there. It's a kind of community of experts talking to one another. So I think that's part of the answer, is kind of to create sort of silos at the get-go, so people are sort of funneled into the right place. And on the question of what we do with the things we don't take up. I think this is something we need to really work out, because if you, everyone who fed in an idea on any of these crowdsourcing exercises gets a kind of generic response that tells you what's been done. You know, go to this site or have a look at this video and we'll tell you about all the regulations that have changed thanks to all the great responses. But we haven't yet come up with a way of giving people direct feedback on good ideas. Like if something went down to the wire and for whatever reason we couldn't do it, they don't get a good enough response yet. I think that for the kind of next phase of this, the kind of Jimmy Wales sort of sponsored phase, that's something we're going to have to really crack, because, yeah, we haven't quite got it yet.
Thanks.
It seems like you guys tried a couple of different ways to engage folks in your community. One was direct citizen engagement with the government kind of guiding the process through the web. The other one is providing open data so that people can do what they want with it.
Yeah.
Did you find that there was more success with one way or the other? And conversely, did you find that the government employees were more willing to do one versus the other?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that it's hard to answer, just because, you know, with open data, what happens to it is much more diffuse. We don't kind of see what happens at neighborhood level, at community level. My hunch, to be honest, is that open data is the kind of is key, right? That really great, unexpected things happen with open data that government can't predict. It's a profound, you know, open approach. But I do think that no matter what we do on open data, we have to keep trying to do the central government stuff, the directed stuff, because with all the, you know, will in the world, central government is going to still keep designing legislation, still keep passing laws, and open data can impact on that, but it won't necessarily reconfigure the process. So I think we need both. But, you know, I think you're right that, well, I think my hunch is that the local open data stuff is going to change society. This stuff, hopefully, that will change government.
And did the government staff choose one or the other? Did they pull one or the other?
No, I think that, to be honest, they're initially skeptical of both. I think that the crowdsourcing, all the examples I've shown today, regulation, legislation, etc., are, to be fair, quite a headache for civil servants. They've got to process lots of ideas. They've got to kind of read a whole bunch of submissions. Someone's got to do that, right? And whereas open data, well, it might be a fight to get the data out. Government's very protective of data. Once it's out there in the world, civil servants kind of don't need to think too much about it, right? The crowd gets on with doing good stuff. So I think that this, you know, I think that the government machine is probably a bit more skeptical about the stuff I've described, but for kind of human reasons. It's just a pain in the arse. It's easier to do things in the old way than in the new way. And I think part of the challenge is to think about how government is structured, who works in government, how departments are built, so that you have maybe more capacity to do this kind of stuff without it being such a headache. Thanks.
Hello. I'm working for the Norwegian government, developing solutions for communication, mainly one-way communication, which is the traditional way for governments to communicate.
Yeah.
And I think it's quite fascinating what you're saying, but it's not technologically so important. It's really about politics.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of wondering, how are you being supported by the Prime Minister? How do you fit in? Because bureaucrats normally would oppose people like you very strongly. So could you say something about the kind of surroundings you have and the kind of support you have?
Yeah, well, look, I'm very lucky. The Prime Minister, the Chancellor, as I said right at the beginning, are geeks, right? And just be open about that. They get it. And so we have a huge amount of kind of cover and support for when things go wrong, etc. When the ideas came in for this on spending, George Osborne, the Chancellor, said, well, I'd love to meet the people who sent in the best responses. On regulation and the red tape challenge, the Prime Minister actively involved in posting videos and looking at some of the entries that come in. So we've been quite lucky, I think, that we have leadership in the British government. You know, the two top people in the British government really get this stuff. Sort of want to make it happen. I work on all areas of policy, from, you know, education to health to international development, etc. But, you know, this stuff just informs our work, and I think that's also key, is that it's not a sort of tech silo. It's not some dudes wearing a Red Dwarf t-shirt in the basement. This is sort of part and parcel of the kind of policy-making process. And I think that maybe is why this is beginning to stick. We've got a lot more to do, but I think that's why we've been able to make a bit of headway, is that it's right at the center of the policy process, and we have support from the top.
This question is a little bit about your feedback, again. Do you have a way to get back to people who are just saying something that's totally bat crazy?
Yeah.
Because when you open it up to the public, you get all kinds of crazy shit. Yeah. So both it's, and sometimes it's just absolutely dead wrong,
yeah.
which is crazy.
Yeah.
And people need that feedback in a democracy in order to actually understand how government functions.
Well, I say it's a great question, and it's not something we've done until this very latest red tape challenge, this thing on regulation. And because, and relevant to that other question, because we've got these very narrow silos, you know, what do you think about blood plasma regulation? What do you think about seafarers regulation? It's a much smaller conversation in each little silo. And so we do have civil servants taking part in that conversation, posting up, actually, you're complaining about this regulation, but it was repealed 5 years ago, and if it's still a problem to you, call this number because it shouldn't be, or whatever. So there's much more of that. But again, a kind of challenge for all of us, really, and is how can you sort of systematize that kind of feedback? Because it's very labor-intensive. And certainly one of the challenges I've faced, with, in spite of all the great support, is how can we justify having a team of maybe 50, 100 civil servants helping on some of this stuff? They could be doing other things. How do you justify that process? And I think that's a sort of generational challenge, really. It's a bit like the challenge we faced when we started to say, look, blogs are important, and online sites are important. So instead of the press office just dealing with traditional newspapers, we should have people dealing with the blogs. And again, that was a big challenge in sort of how are resources allocated commensurate with the challenge of the 21st century. So I think we've still got some way to go. But on this very latest initiative, we are doing that. But whether we'll be able to keep it up is a challenge. All right, I think one last question, and you can all go and have some coffee, and I'll go and smash my computer up.
Hello. So I guess for some of the British people in the room and also those who are like following along on Twitter, kind of like the elephant in the room here feels a bit like the NHS reform stuff and just like the kind of feeling yeah. of the lack of consultation, feedback, openness, yeah. transparency, willingness to engage. Like it's kind of weird to not talk about that in this context as well. So
totally
I'm just wondering if you can say.
Yeah, no, it's totally fair. And, you know, as I tried to say towards the end, I feel like we've done some really good things, but they're quite ad hoc, right? You know, this one process. There's lots of other work of government that's going on as it's always gone on. Closed rooms, crap consultations, PDF documents read by no one except hardcore lobbyists or vested interests, etc. And the examples you gave are arguably, you know, that kind of old world. But, you know, what I can assure you we're trying to do, you know, with Jimmy Wales, with other people, is try and embed this across government. And I think it is, frankly, a kind of five-year process. You know, a lot of processes have got to change. A lot of the way civil service departments work has got to change. So, I mean, unfortunately, I think there's still going to be a few more of those old-fashioned ways of doing things. And the argument I make internally is that, you know, if you have a closed process, it's a suboptimal process, and bad things happen, whether that's regulation being poorly drafted, legislation being poorly designed, new ideas you're not getting. Let's open this up. But it will take time, and you're right, we're not there yet. Okay, well, listen, thank you all for joining me this morning. Sorry again about the IT. If there are any civil servants from the UK in the room, they would probably say this proof that this technology stuff is never going to take off, it's never going to work. But I hope that's been useful. I'll stick around if anyone has any more questions. I'm really grateful to you for your this crowd full of ideas and suggestions. And we're not going to go away at this. We're going to keep sticking at it. So if you have any poems about seafarers or any photos of gay sailors, there's going to be plenty of forums online that you can post them up and I can receive. So thanks for that. Thanks for coming. Thank you.